So the point of last lecture was to introduce you to the three most physically important classes of metrics: the maximally symmetric spacetimes, the Friedman, Robertson, Walker spacetimes, which will actually be the cosmological spacetimes of interest to us, and the black hole spacetimes. And so last lecture was taken up with giving a simple sort of unified derivation of all of the maximally symmetric spacetimes as simple embeddings, quadratic embeddings in some higher dimensional flat space. And then showing the relationship between all of those and the FRW metrics, which we saw were made use of are precisely the metrics that can be sliced into one time direction and three spatial directions, such that the three spatial directions always have, as their three-dimensional metric, one of these maximally symmetric spaces, either the k equals plus one three-sphere or the k equals zero three-dimensional Euclidean space or the k equals minus one three-dimensional hyperboloid. I didn't get a chance to say anything about black holes, and because I'm supposed to be focusing on cosmology, I won't say too much about them here. If you want an introduction to the two most important black hole spacetimes, I encourage you to look at the notes if you haven't met them before. In particular, there's the most famous and one of the first solutions found of Einstein's equations is the Schwarzschild metric. And that describes a non-spinning black hole, a black hole that's just sitting there but is spherically symmetric, not spinning at all. And then there is the spinning generalization of that. In general, black holes will spin, and that's the so-called Kerr metric. So this guy, to a very good approximation, not only describes non-spinning black holes, but it also describes the space-time outside any sort of collapsed object that's not a black hole, like the Earth or the Sun, any isolated collapsed body. The metric outside of the body is very well approximated by the Schwarzschild metric. It's really only once a thing collapses down to near its Schwarzschild radius that the effects of its spin become a very important perturbation on the space-time outside the body. So once you've actually collapsed down to a black hole, like, so the Earth is spinning, and so in principle, general relativity predicts that there is some effect due to that, that if you're an astronaut floating out in space, the fact that the Earth is spinning will by itself, according to general relativity, will for example, cause you to drag slowly around in orbit around the Earth in the same direction that the Earth is spinning. But for the Earth, that's a very tiny effect, very, very difficult to measure. But for real astrophysical black holes, they're surrounded by accretion disks that are dumping matter onto them, the real black holes in the real physical universe. And it appears to be typical that they have very high spins, and that their spin is having can have very dramatic effects on the, in the parts of the accretion disk that are closest to the black hole. So I just wanted to say that a couple more things about what is the relationship between the symmetries of these guys. Basically, we said the maximally symmetric spacetimes. You can think of Minkowski space. In Minkowski space, you know what the symmetries are. There's 10 of them. There's the fact that you can translate yourself by any amount. You can translate your laboratory to any point in the space-time. You can translate in the time direction or any of the three spatial directions, and no observation you do will be able to tell you whether your laboratory was over here or over here. That's four translations. Alternatively, you can rotate your laboratory. So instead of pointing your apparatuses this way, you can rotate them in this way. Won't be able to tell the difference, so that's three rotations. And then you can also boost your laboratory, move at some speed v through the space-time. And again, the symmetry of the space-time will forbid you from being able to determine whether you're in some sense at rest or moving with respect to Minkowski space. So there's 10 symmetries, and all of the maximally symmetric metrics, the De Sitter metric and the anti-De Sitter metric, have also 10 symmetries. And in fact, I think maybe that will be explored in the Friday tutorial, so maybe I won't say more about that. The Friedman-Robertson-Walker metrics, we said, have less symmetry. They have only 6 symmetries, because the idea is if this is the time direction, again, the FRW metrics are exactly the ones that may be sliced up in the spatial direction, such that, so there's no particular symmetry in this direction. So instead of, so we used to have 4 translations, an arbitrary translation in time and 3 in space. Now the time translation is no longer a symmetry, but we can still move our lab to any point on a spatial slice, and it's equivalent. So we have 3 translations. And then furthermore, if we take our laboratory here and if we rotate within our spatial slice and point our telescope or our apparatus in a different direction, we'll make the same observations in such a space-time. So we have three rotations also for 6 symmetries. But there's no boost symmetries either. So the 3 boosts are also gone. There's a preferred spatial slicing in cosmology. There's a cosmic rest frame that's just an observed fact, and you can tell if you're moving with respect to it, and we'll be discussing later how you can tell, and also why we are so close to approximately at rest with respect to it. So Schwarzschild, Schwarzschild, if you compare it to the maximally symmetric slices, the story is different. Now there's a preferred spatial point, the origin of the black hole, so the center of the black hole. So there's you're no longer free to translate spatially, but you're still free to translate in time. The space-time is just static. So there's still a time translation. So this four gets reduced to 1, just time translations. That's the only translational symmetry. And then there's full rotational symmetry. If you the black hole is spherically symmetric, so you can rotate it any way you want, and you can't tell that you've rotated it. So there's 1 translation plus 3 rotational symmetries. And then Kerr is a little bit less symmetric than that. It still has time translational symmetry, but now it's spinning. It has some preferred axis picked out by the axis around which the space-time is spinning, and around which you will be dragged if you're just a observer hovering outside the black hole. So it now has symmetry under rotations about that 1 axis, but any of the other 2 rotations, which would change that axis, are no longer symmetries of the space-time. So it's just 1 plus 1, time translations plus axial symmetry. And the only thing I wanted to say, a qualitative remark, is that normally, somehow in physics and math, the things with the highest symmetry are the most beautiful. But there's no question, Kerr is like the most awesome metric that's ever, the most awesome solution of Einstein's equations that's ever been found. It's absolutely has far more beautiful properties than it has any right to, given its measly number of symmetries. And it happens to be the case that it's believed to be the case, not proven to be the case, but believed to be the case, that in an arbitrary generic gravitational collapse, you take any pile of junk you want and make it unstable to collapse, and then it collapses to form a black hole, and initially it's a big mess, but then it very rapidly settles down to exactly this metric. And so this is what people say when they mean a black hole has no hair. They mean that it settles down to, at the end of the day, whatever complicated system you started with, it settles down to a solution exterior to the black hole that is just perfectly described by this simple metric that only has these 2 free parameters, the mass and the spin. So somehow it's a bit of a miracle that even though Einstein's equations are these nonlinear partial differential equations, which normally you don't really have much of a hope of solving, you can't find any solutions to a nonlinear partial differential equation. But in fact, fortunately, for the Einstein equations, there do appear to be solutions for that well approximate nearly all of the physical systems of interest in the universe. And in particular, even in the case of lowest symmetry, there is this that we can sort of write down the general solution that describes the end state of the collapse, and it's just crazy beautiful. So in regard to that, I just want to make one more remark, which is that normally when you're introduced to the Kerr metric, there's kind of two standard coordinate systems. Normally when you're introduced to the Kerr metric, you're introduced to it in so-called Boyer-Lindquist coordinates. These are the ones that are commonly used for astrophysical calculations, because these are the ones that when you take the limit that the spin goes to zero, they reduce to these Schwarzschild coordinates. So it's clear that in some sense they're just a perturbation or a deformation of the Schwarzschild metric. But then there are these other coordinates, the Kerr-Shield coordinates, which are the ones that Kerr originally discovered when he was like 24. So clock is ticking, guys. In these coordinates, the beauty of the metric is much more manifest. And in fact, in these coordinates, these are sort of quasi-Cartesian coordinates, like the quasi-Cartesian coordinates that we used to derive the maximally symmetric metrics. And in fact, in those coordinates, this bears a kind of striking resemblance to the maximally symmetric metrics. Anyway, that's all I'm going to say. I'm just trying to get you excited about the Kerr metric. I should also mention, David is like one of the world's experts on the Kerr metric and its beautiful properties. So if you want to know more about it, ask him. Okay. But now our job for the next two lectures is to get to know the Friedman-Robertson-Walker metrics well enough that we have sort of a good physical picture of what they are. What we have at the moment is a bit formal. So we want to know what particles do as they propagate through that space-time, and we want to know how the space-time interacts with matter that's in it. How does the matter change the evolution of the space-time, and how does the evolution of the space-time affect the matter? So the idea is hopefully to culminate by the end of Friday's lecture with, no lecture tomorrow, I remind you, but hopefully to culminate by the end of Friday's lecture with a description of the lambda CDM model, the sort of current standard picture of the universe, so we can at least have a physical picture of roughly speaking what the model is that describes that appears to describe the observations today, and then we can next week get into the question of what's puzzling about that model, what are the puzzles? Okay, so let's look at FRW now. So what we said last time, we derived these maximally symmetric metrics. We derived the maximally symmetric metric with signature P, Q, in other words, P space directions and Q time directions, and curvature K, which could be plus or minus 1 or 0. And then we said that in particular, our four-dimensional cosmological space-time, the universe on large scales, appears to be described by a metric that is a maximally symmetric space-time with three space and no time directions. And then we add time by just saying, well, we add a time coordinate, and then this scale factor is just as the scale factor, if this is the scale factor as a function of time, if it goes like this, that's saying that this spatial surface, let's say it's a three sphere, as time evolves, it's growing and it undergoes a little bump and then it grows more, for example. So A of T just represents how the spatial surface stretches or shrinks as a function of time. Okay, so more explicitly, in the coordinates we used last time, those quasi-Cartesian coordinates, this metric looks like, you know, what we found was that this metric is, there's the Kronecker delta, and then okay, and now, so the first thing I want to say is that this metric is correct, but these are not the coordinates that you'll usually see in a cosmology textbook. There are two other, well, so there are a couple of other standard coordinate systems, and so we just want to introduce those right now. So, first of all, what is usually done is you change to spherical coordinates. So if we just take those spatial coordinates, x1 and x2 and x3, and change to ordinary spherical coordinates, so x1 is equal to r sine theta cosine phi, r sine theta sine phi, and r cosine theta. Then if you just take those expressions and their corresponding expressions for dx1 and dx2 and dx3, plug them in there, simplify a little bit, you'll find that the metric becomes, you know what, before I say that, I wanted to make one remark. So last time when we found the metric of maximal symmetry, it always depended on this parameter rho, which had units of length and which represented the radius of curvature. So in the spherical case, that rho was the radius of the sphere. Now the one thing I wanted to say was, you know, if you notice that now that we have both rho and a in the game, we're always free to redefine the coordinates and the scale factor in such a way as to set rho to 1. So in other words, suppose you took your x coordinates and you define new coordinates x twiddle by pulling out a factor of rho, and then you also defined a new scale factor a twiddle by pulling out a factor of 1 over rho. So suppose you plug that in here. So if you plug in x is equal to rho x twiddle, this becomes k rho squared x twiddle. Then we also get rho squared x twiddle up here. So the rho squareds cancel here. Here these become dx twiddle times rho squared. And then this guy becomes a twiddle squared times 1 over rho squared. So that rho squared cancels that rho squared. And so the new metric just looks exactly the same as the old metric, except a has become a twiddle, x has become x twiddle, and rho has become 1. Okay, so we're always free to do that, and conventionally that's always done. So from now on, I'll just assume that we've rescaled the spatial coordinates and the scale factor so that the radius of curvature of the spatial slice is 1. It's just a constant 1 for all times. And any expansion or any expansion or contraction of the universe, we don't think of as expanding or contracting rho. We think of it as just an overall factor that expands or that multiplies the intrinsic spatial metric of radius 1. Okay. So yeah, so having said that, what I was going to say is now if you take that metric with rho is equal to 1 and you make this change of coordinates, then you get, you know, you just change the spatial coordinates to ordinary spherical coordinates, you get this, you get the first standard form. Okay, where d omega squared is going to be my shorthand for the metric on the unit 2 sphere. So in other words, those are just the, these are the, this is the angular part of the metric, it looks like. Okay, so that's one sort of radial coordinate, but there is another conventional radial coordinate which is also more useful for certain purposes, and so to get there we define, so the new radial coordinate chi is related to r as follows. We define r to be function S sub k of chi, where S sub k of chi is defined to be just sine of chi when k is equal to plus 1, chi when k is equal to 0, and sinh of chi when k is equal to minus 1. So if you just, again, if you just replace r and dr by this expression and the differential of this expression in this metric, it's I won't go through the algebra on the board, but it's straightforward to check, and you can check it. It's all in the notes if you want. So, you know, basically the idea here is that when the space is curved, there's going to be some funny business in the spatial part of the metric, and in the R coordinates, this part looks just like it would in ordinary Minkowski space. This is just how the d theta and d phi terms would look if you rewrote the Minkowski metric in polar coordinates. But this part is not in Minkowski space. This would just be dr squared, but now we have this funny factor of 1 minus kr squared. On the other hand, when we switch to the chi coordinates, this first term simplifies. It just becomes d chi squared. So now it looks just like it would in Minkowski, like the radial term in the Minkowski metric. But this term becomes more complicated. It becomes this function sk squared, sk of chi squared times d omega squared. Okay, so those are the two conventional radial coordinates that one uses in cosmology. And so let's just draw a picture of what's going on there. So here I'm drawing a picture of, the easiest case to draw is the case where k is equal to plus 1. And so the spatial slice is a 3 sphere. And so now because I can only draw a 2 sphere on the board, you'll have to just imagine this is a 3 sphere, but so the idea is that I've drawn only two of them, but there are three there are three spatial directions x1, x2, x3, which are in this plane, and then this is the fourth direction x4 in the embedding. So here I'm drawing the 3 sphere back in its four-dimensional embedding space, and the vertical direction here is the fourth coordinate that I'm going to eliminate to get a purely three-dimensional metric. And so r is just the distance from the origin. So suppose this is the origin of coordinates up here, okay, the origin of spatial coordinates. So this is r is equal to chi is equal to 0 up here. And now you want to measure the distance. You want to say what is the coordinate, the radial distance of some circle out here, a constant distance away from the origin. Well, the r coordinate is just it's the normal flat distance measured using the x1, x2, x3 coordinates. It's the normal radial distance on that the three-dimensional Euclidean space perpendicular to here. So, in other words, it's this. It's the straight distance from the axis to the point in question. So that's what the coordinate r means geometrically. And then chi, we've just switched to chi is this angle here. So you see that. So you can see here that if this is a we've normalized the coordinates, so this is a unit sphere, and so indeed, if chi is the angular distance between this point and this point as measured from the center of the sphere, then R, you know, there's this triangle where this side has length 1, and so R is indeed just sine chi. Okay, so that's intuitively R and chi are just two different natural geometric ways to measure the distance between these two points. R is sort of the natural one with respect to the embedding space. Chi is the natural one, if you want, when you're restricted to the three-dimensional space itself. Okay? So now, unfortunately, that is not all. There is one other choice, which is that, so t is one conventional coordinate, but another common thing to do is to pull out a of t, so that instead of just multiplying the spatial part of the metric, it multiplies the whole metric. Okay, and so we can do that by defining t is equal to a d eta. Okay, so if we change to a new dt is equal to a d eta, or in other words, if we integrate that, that says that eta minus some arbitrary value of eta is equal to the integral from some arbitrary value of t to t of dt prime over a of t prime. So if we do that, we just rewrite either of these expressions, but now the a is in front of everything. So in other words, this dot 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 means everything in here. In other words, this metric becomes this one, where you just take this stuff, put it in there, and this metric becomes this one, where you take this stuff and put it in there. Okay, and so those are the four conventional choices for coordinates on FRW spacetime. It just happens that different coordinates are useful for doing different things. But you know, it's really ultimately rather simple. It's just there's two different natural radial coordinates. That's one possibility. There's two natural time coordinates. This one is usually called t is called physical time or co-moving time or cosmological time, and eta is called conformal time because in that language, nothing in here depends on eta. This metric is all of the coefficients in the metric depend purely on the spatial coordinates, and the entire time dependence is an overall so-called conformal factor multiplying the metric. In particular, an observed fact about the universe is that, as far as we can tell, we live in a universe with k equals zero. The simple case where this is really just nothing but where we're here. So in that case, when k is zero, this is just dr squared plus r squared d omega squared. That's just the spatial part of the Minkowski metric. That's just the three-dimensional Euclidean metric, but written in polar coordinates. And here, and in terms of conformal time, if we set k equal to zero, we just have minus d eta squared plus the three-dimensional Euclidean metric dx1 squared plus dx2 squared plus dx3 squared. So that's really just static Minkowski space. And so in that case, life is rather simple. It really is just saying every three-dimensional slice is three-dimensional Euclidean space, and in this language, that's just being stretched as a function of time. And in this language, the universe is really just Minkowski space, but is being stretched as a function of time. Okay, and so now, you know, let me draw a new sphere. Whoops. Sorry, wrong button. Is it time for a joke? It probably is. So, I'm back at my wife's grandmother, Grandma Frida's house, and she says, "Ah, something, something, something," and my wife says she has a piece of advice for you. She says it's better to have 100 friends than $100, because you can always ask every friend for $2. Anyway. There's a related one. Well, anyway, I gotta save my stuff. I gotta save, there's only so many, I've got a finite amount of material. Okay, so, you know, in practice, I always kind of like to draw, even though, as I just said, so our actual universe is the three-dimensional slices are infinite Euclidean space, and the problem with that is it's just kind of hard to somehow it's just not as evocative to draw it on the board. So I end up drawing the closed three sphere anyway. Now, we could very well live in a universe that actually is, if we could observe the whole of it, a three sphere, and then the fact that as far as we can tell. It is flat Euclidean space, it's consistent with the k equals zero universe, is just saying that the region of the universe that we can actually observe is some relatively small region around our position, a region so small that it's very well approximated by flat space. Just like on Earth, you know, if you explore a small enough amount of the Earth, you can describe it just as flat space. Okay, so, you know, so now the picture is what you should imagine, the picture you should have in mind is that those coordinates, x, the spatial coordinates there, they're so-called co-moving coordinates. So you should imagine those co-moving coordinates, so the coordinates r and theta, all the spatial coordinates we've discussed, whether they be the x's or the r or chi or theta or phi, you should think of them all as dots drawn with a marker on some balloon, on this sphere, which is some balloon, and then the expansion of the universe is just, you know, someone is blowing up the balloon. So as a of t increases by a factor of two, that's saying that the radius of this balloon has been increased by a factor of two, and so when that happens, the distance, the physical distance. You know, the actual distance between two co-moving coordinates, two dots that I've drawn on the balloon, will correspondingly increase by a factor of two. And so in particular, you can see that so the universe is expanding, and in this picture, if you think of each of these dots as being a galaxy that we can observe with a telescope, because the universe is expanding, then we, who see photons that travel along the surface of the balloon, we see those dots moving away from us. It's like they're all receding. And furthermore, a dot that is, if we compare, you know, this galaxy, so this is us here. This is you. Okay, and you're pointing your telescope. This is your telescope. This is a horrible picture. This is a waste of a picture. Okay, so that's you. That's your little telescope. You're looking out in this direction, and you compare a nearby galaxy with another galaxy that's twice as far away. So let's say this guy is 1 unit away, 1 megaparsec away, and this guy is 2 megaparsecs away. And then the universe increases by, let's say it grows by 1%, okay, in some fixed time. So this guy, the distance here increases to 1.01 megaparsecs, whereas this guy increases to 2.02 megaparsecs. So in other words, in the same amount of time, the galaxy that is twice as far away from you has managed to move twice as far. Its distance has also grown by twice as much as the nearer galaxy. So this guy appears to be receding from you at twice the speed as this guy. Okay, and so this is known as Hubble's law. This was the way that the expansion of the universe was discovered in the 1920s. Was Hubble pointed his telescope at galaxies and measured in a way that we'll describe in a moment how fast they were receding, and he found this law that galaxies that were n times further away were receding n times as fast. Yeah.
How do you know how far away they were?
Yeah. So that is an extremely well. There's how he did. So he there are these stars called Cepheid variables where if you measure they pulsate, and if you measure how fast they pulsate, the physics is understood so that and they're calibrated locally if you measure their pulsations, you can determine how intrinsically bright they are. And then if you know how intrinsically bright they are, and then you know how, in other words, how luminous they are, and you also know how bright they appear to you, you can tell how far away they are. So that only works for rather nearby things, though. And so the question of exactly how you measure how far away something is, what its physical distance is, it's a very tricky thing to do in cosmology. It's been a thing where the error bars have always been large, and even in modern times haven't gotten very much smaller. He could do it with relatively nearby things using these Cepheid variables in the 20s. And also he got the answer wrong by a factor of 10. He was calibrating the distance because he couldn't calibrate the distances. He can measure quite well how fast they're moving away because he sees the spectra. He sees their atomic spectra redshifted, Doppler shifted, as if they were moving away at some velocity, and that he can measure quite accurately. But it is indeed, it's been always a very fraught subject how to estimate the distances, and so yeah. In fact, he got the whole thing wrong by a factor of 10. But. But anyway. Nevertheless, the trend that he observed turned out to be real, and anyway, that's a very long and interesting story. It's a very long and interesting story about how you actually calibrate distances to measure the Hubble constant today. But let me postpone that until after class. Okay, so that's Hubble's law. That observation was the first, really. So Einstein found general relativity in the 1915, and then a small group of people got to work finding solutions of it, and found that there were solutions in which the universe was expanding and contracting, and Einstein dismissed those solutions as unphysical, historically the story was that then Hubble came along and found that. Actually, the universe did appear to be expanding, and so Einstein and others had to revise their theoretical picture. So the other thing to say is that if you instead of pointing your telescope this way and measuring how fast things are receding as a function of distance in this direction, you do it in this direction along the sphere. You'll get exactly the same answer. So in other words, that's a manifestation of the isotropy of the universe, the fact that the universe is rotationally invariant. So if you measure Hubble's law in this direction, you'll find the same curve as if you measure curve of distance versus speed as if you measure it in this direction. So again, that's the lingo, you call that isotropy of the universe. It's a measured fact about the universe. And then the other thing, which this model says, is that you know, you, intuitively you might think that if you're surrounded by a bunch of galaxies and they're all expanding away from you, it sounds a lot like you're at the center of the universe and there was some explosion and you happen to be right at the center. But you can see in this picture that that's not the case. You know, if you were sitting over here on this galaxy and looking out at nearby galaxies and then galaxies twice as far away, you know, you'd see exactly the same expansion law over here as this guy measures over here. And again, that's the basically spatial translational invariance or homogeneity of the FRW universe. Let me see, did I want to say anything else about that? That's it. So I next wanted to go on to talk about geodesics. So now if a particle is moving through the spacetime, you know, what are its basic properties? So there's a single simple rule you should remember, and that we'll derive right now that characterizes the whole story. So basically, what we want to derive is that the physical momentum of a particle drops as 1 over a, quote unquote, redshifts as 1 over a, proportional to 1 over a, spatial momentum does, in an expanding universe. And then we want to derive that, and we want to see what does that really mean for relativistic particles on the one hand, and for non-relativistic particles on the other. Okay, surprisingly large number of the observed features of the universe are accounted for by that simple rule. So that's kind of one thing worth remembering. So let's derive that. So remember that last time I said, if you there's two ways to derive the geodesic equation. There's a way that you there's a notion of geodesic. So let's imagine you have some curve, x of t, or x of x mu of lambda through your spacetime, and so that the momentum of this particle is p mu is equal to dx mu d lambda. So lambda is a so-called affine parameter along the curve. In the massive case, it's more conventional to write to define lambda is to define the proper time to be m, the mass of the particle, times lambda. So normally you think of the curve as being x mu of tau, the proper time of the particle, but that definition fails in the case where m goes to zero, the proper time doesn't advance for a massless particle. So since we want to treat massive particles and massless particles together in the following derivation, I'll just switch over to this affine parameter lambda, which is finite for both types of particles. Okay, and now we could, one way to calculate the geodesic equation would be to calculate u mu, in other words, so u mu is proportional to p mu, but so the tangent vector to the curve, its derivative, its directional derivative along the curve, set that equal to zero. But there's an easier way to do it, which is that we take the metric. So we said the metric is, for example, we could write it this way, dt squared plus a squared of t gij 30 k dxi dxj. where this guy doesn't, this guy does not depend on time, it only depends on the spatial coordinates. And we convert this to a Lagrangian by just replacing dt by t prime, in other words, dt d lambda. So we convert this to a Lagrangian. So I replace dt by t prime. I have minus t prime squared, and then plus a squared of t dij. Okay, where I'm using a prime here to denote. So prime on a quantity denotes that it's been differentiated with respect to lambda, the affine parameter, to distinguish that from a dot, which, as we said last time, I conventionally reserve for if a quantity has a dot over it, that means that it's been differentiated with respect to cosmic time t. Let's derive the. So, you know, we can derive four different Euler-Lagrange equations for this because we have four coordinates. We can differentiate with respect to t or any of the spatial coordinates. But we only need to differentiate with respect to t for the following argument. So the Euler-Lagrange equation will be dl dt is equal to partial l partial t prime. Okay, so the left-hand side, if the only t dependence in the metric, the only explicit dependence on t is here. So if we take dl dt, that's just a times a prime times this spatial metric times xi prime xj prime. But now here, xi prime and xj prime are nothing but pi and pj. So I'll just change notation to pi pj. This should be a dot here because I'm taking the derivative with respect to time, not with respect to lambda. Sorry about that. Let me just pull an a squared out of here. I'll write this as a dot over a. And then a squared gij okay, but so now this guy is just, this is the Hubble expansion rate we defined last time, that's just h. This is just the three-dimensional part of the physical metric, so this is the co-moving part times a squared, so and so if I take the three-dimensional components of the momentum and dot them together using the three-dimensional part of the metric, that is just the magnitude of the physical momentum squared. So I'll call that capital P squared. Okay, so we've evaluated that side of the equation. This side of the equation is easier to evaluate. We just say dl dt prime is minus t prime, and then t prime is nothing but the zero component of the momentum, p zero, and so then we have to take that, prime that again. So that's nothing but minus p zero prime. Okay, so let me just rewrite. So in other words, the Euler-Lagrange equation becomes minus p. Minus p0 prime is equal to h capital P squared, the magnitude of the three momentum squared. And now let's just use one more trick, which is that if the particle has mass m, the mass of the particle is equal to the square, the four-dimensional dot product of the four momentum with itself, which in our case is just P0 minus P0 squared plus the three metric dotted into the three-dimensional momentum, which is nothing but what we previously defined as capital P squared. So this is minus P0 squared plus capital P squared. And now if we just take D of both sides of this equation, well, the mass is a constant, so D of that is 0. And so this says that 0 equals minus 2P0 dP0 plus 2 capital P d capital P. So let's use this to eliminate. Okay, let's take, instead of just taking d, let's take d d lambda. So this is dp0 d lambda, or in other words, p0 prime, and this is d capital P d lambda, or in other words, capital P prime. So now if I just solve for this p0 prime and eliminate it here, I get that this is minus P prime over P0. And now, if I just notice that, so P prime is dP d lambda, P naught is by definition dT d lambda. So the d lambdas cancel. So this is these guys really combine to just give d capital B P dT. So this is minus P d capital P dt is equal to this side, which is h is dA dt over A times P squared. Okay, so now I just see this is why normally I don't do the algebra on the board because I take forever to do it. But this is so simple but see now I've made it take forever. It's really supposed to be that there's a very simple argument here that anyway, okay, it's too late to stop now. So let's cancel a factor of p squared from both sides. So that kills that guy, and that kills the two. Multiply both sides, divide both sides by p, and multiply by dt. So in other words, this becomes dp over p is equal to minus dA over A. And so if we integrate that, that says log of p is equal to minus log of A plus a constant. Or in other words, p is proportional to 1 over A. Okay, so that's the thing we wanted to derive. That the momentum, whether you're massless or massive, the magnitude of your three-dimensional physical momentum redshifts away as 1 over A. So as the universe expands and A increases, it sucks momentum away from you. So now what does that actually physically mean in the two cases of interest? One where you're a non-relativistic particle moving through the universe, like you or me or a galaxy. We're really very non-relativistic in the scheme of things. I mean, especially, you know, you guys. That means nothing. Okay, so if you, so in the non-relativistic case, the magnitude of your momentum is m times your speed v. And so your m is constant. So if p is proportional to 1 over a, that's really saying that your velocity is proportional to 1 over a. So in other words, if we go back to our picture here, if you draw a dot on the balloon, and now if you're just riding along at rest on one of those dots, your v is 0. And according to this equation, as the universe expands, v is proportional to 1 over a, it just stays 0. Okay, so if you're at rest at one of these dots, you remain at rest. Massive observer at rest remains at rest, and that's called that observer is called a so-called co-moving observer. And the coordinates is these spatial coordinates we're using, the ones that are drawn as dots on the balloon that are just fixed on the spatial surface, which then expands. Those are correspondingly called co-moving coordinates. Okay, anyway, co-moving coordinates. And you know, co-moving just means the coordinates are moving with the observer, and the observer is moving with the coordinates. That's what the co is. Okay, and this process is called Hubble drag, or you sometimes say that such an observer feels Hubble friction. You know, even if they're just moving through empty space, somehow their velocity is being sucked away by the expansion of the universe. So that effect is called Hubble drag, and physically you can understand what's happening. Let's say at some moment in time you're moving with velocity v, so you're traveling toward this galaxy, but the universe is expanding, so this galaxy is moving away from you with some velocity. So once you get to this galaxy, your speed relative to it will be, you know, if it was very nearby, your speed relative to it will be the velocity that you had relative to this guy minus the recessional velocity of this guy. Your velocity will be a little bit less when you pass this guy. And so now you continue along to try to pass another galaxy, and again, your velocity here is now reduced, but you're trying to catch up with someone that's moving away from you. So once you get over to him, your velocity relative to him, relative to that co-moving galaxy or co-moving observer, will be slower still. So this is, you know, physically there's nothing mysterious about this effect. It's just that it's your velocity relative to co-moving observers that we're talking about here that falls to zero as the universe expands. Maybe one other bit of terminology that's worth saying is that if you're not a co-moving observer and you instead have some velocity v relative to the co-moving observer at the same point in space as you, that is called your quote-unquote peculiar velocity. Okay, and so, for example, in our universe today, it so happens that most things have a peculiar velocity of roughly, you know, a couple hundred kilometers per second. So on average, they're rather close. This is very non-relativistic velocity. So on average, they're rather close to being in the cosmic rest frame. They're rather close to being co-moving observers. But a random galaxy or a cluster of galaxies will not be precisely at rest. It'll typically have some little peculiar velocity, like our Milky Way galaxy, of order a couple hundred kilometers per second. Okay, so that's massive particles. Now massless particles, so now their velocity doesn't get reduced as the universe expands, because relative to any observer, as light passes them, they will see it moving at the speed of light. For a massless particle, a particle that's so relativistic that it's for all intents and purposes massless, it's the magnitude of its momentum is equal to its energy. And so that's the thing that gets redshifted away as the universe expands. So according to, as measured by co-moving observers, as a photon goes zooming across the universe and passes a bunch of co-moving observers along the way, so this guy will measure it to have some frequency, and then by the time it makes it over here, the universe has grown in size by a factor of 2, and so the frequency, this observer will say the frequency of the photon has been reduced by a factor of 2, and if another factor of 2 growth has occurred by this time, the frequencies of the photon will be reduced by yet another factor of 2. So in other words, the frequency is proportional to 1 over a as a particle propagates across the universe, or in other words, its wavelength grows proportional to a. Okay, so in other words, that's an intuitive result. That as you have two observers, and they the distance between the physical distance between them stretches by a factor of n, that the corresponding length of a photon between them stretches by the same factor in the same time. So again, physically, I should stop. Okay, physically, that is just another way of saying what, it's just an equivalent way of saying what Hubble saw. Hubble, we said, looked out at distant galaxies, and he saw that they were receding from him. So how did he see that they were receding from him? He measured that, if let's say they emitted and they, let's say there was a hydrogen cloud and it emitted and it was emitting a couple of characteristic lines, a couple of characteristic atomic transitions that hydrogen atoms emit, then you know what wavelengths those things should be in a lab on Earth, and he would observe the same pattern of lines, but the whole thing was shifted to larger wavelengths. And in the normal, good old non-relativistic days, that effect was already measured. If you took a ball of gas and sent it traveling at some velocity away from you, that you would see an ordinary Doppler shift that would cause the pattern of lines to shift like that. And so that's how Hubble interpreted it. He just said, oh, that's just a Doppler shift in there. That's just saying that I'm seeing those lines Doppler shifted because those galaxies are receding from me. This is just another equivalent way to say the same thing. In GR, in the language of GR, it's true that the galaxies are receding from you, and the interpretation is that they're doing it because in the natural coordinates, the universe itself, the spatial slices of the universe are stretching with respect to time, and the wavelength is stretching right alongside it. So the one other thing that I wanted to get to today that I'll do instead tomorrow is just the structure of horizons in a cosmological space-time. We'll talk about it next time. Future horizons, past horizons, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, where is the limit in scale or in?
That's a good question. I was kind of wondering. I've always wondered whether to include. There's a famous. Yeah, that's a very good question. So, if you have a collection of objects that are so that are sufficiently dense. Their gravitational attraction of one another gets so strong that the overall expansion of the gravitational force, if you want, pulling them away due to the expansion of the universe is negligible in comparison. So between the Earth and the Sun, the gravitational force, attractive force, is just so gigantic relative to the effective gravitational force that would be pulling them away due to the Hubble expansion, that it's, you can totally neglect it. I mean, it plays no role in the solar system. There's a nice model called the spherical top hat model, a spherically symmetric model that where you can see exactly quantitatively how that happens. And so there's a nice model where you can work out everything analytically and see that if you have a little, if the universe is completely uniform density everywhere, but at early times there was a little bump at some particular sphere, in spherical region, there was a little bump where there was more density in there than everywhere else. That region has a little bit more gravity, has a little bit stronger gravitational pull than everywhere else, and so it tends to clump together. It tends to expand less rapidly, than the rest of the universe, and so its over density relative to the rest of the universe grows and grows and grows, until eventually, there's an instability. It starts off having just a little bit more self gravity than the rest of the universe. So it expands just a little bit more slowly, but because it expands more slowly, its density dilutes less quickly, and so at a later time, the density everywhere else has fallen a little bit, and it has fallen less quickly, let's say. So compared to the background, it's become an even bigger bump in density, and that goes on and on until it becomes such a big bump in local density over the density everywhere else in space that its self-gravity gets so strong that it ceases to expand altogether, and it just recollapses down to a galaxy or a cluster of galaxies. So that's actually the physical picture of how the actual structures in the universe, galaxies and clusters, formed. Is that originally the universe had completely uniform density to an accuracy of one part in 100,000, much more uniform than it is today. But then tiny little regions, some regions had slightly more density, some regions had slightly less density, and the regions that had slightly more density expanded slightly slower, so their density got more and more exaggerated relative to the cosmic mean. The regions that had slightly less density expanded slightly faster, so their emptiness got exaggerated relative to the cosmic mean, and that instability grew and grew and grew until today you have gigantic spikes in density, which we call galaxies, and everywhere else there's a nearly empty space. It's kind of a confusing thing, and that's why this example where you can just do it explicitly is nice. But I don't know whether we'll actually do that example in the class, but I can show you where, I can show you where you can do it if you wanted to see it, understand that in more detail. Any other questions? Yeah.
So when we first started this whole analysis and we wrote down the Lagrangian, are we just interpreting, we're just saying that there's an action along the world line of the particle which is proportional to the proper length? Is that
that's another way to derive the geodesic equation. Yeah. That's very closely related to this way of getting the geodesic equation. Exactly.
But is that not what you've done in interpreting the S squared as the Lagrangian?
It's virtually equivalent. You know, it's very closely related. The Lagrangian for a point particle in general relativity is m d tau, and so you might have said, oh, it looks like L is, let's say, d tau d lambda or something like that, and you know you notice that that's not quite what we're doing. We have ds squared here, not ds. So you need to do a bit of thinking to convince yourself that this is the right answer, rather than this. But in spirit, the idea is exactly that you can think of this as being the geodesic equation derived from this Lagrangian.
So you would just find that those two Lagrangians gave the same equations of motion?
So any way you vary this action, if you do it correctly, exactly. That certainly should be true. Yes. So really, it's kind of a matter of convenience that to not have to deal with a square root action. You manipulate things until you can see that you can use ds squared itself as the Lagrangian. Yeah. Okay. Great. So see you on Friday.